From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly are meeting with officials in Mexico today. The visit comes against the backdrop of new orders from President Trump to deport immigrants in the country illegally, not just those who've committed serious crimes. The new enforcement policy is causing deep concern in Mexico about what an influx of deportees might mean. Mexicans fear that refugee and deportee camps might be built all along their northern border. Catholic priest Father Patrick Murphy runs the Casa del Migrante shelter in Tijuana, Mexico. He joins us from there on Skype. Father Murphy, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
What would an influx of deportees mean for Mexico and for your shelter?
Well, if what happens, as President Trump has promised, it could be a disaster if they begin to send thousands of people over the border. You know, we've been doing this for 30 years here at the Casa, but, you know, we could take care of 150 people, not 500 people. So if the thousands come, it's going to be quite a challenge for Mexico, and I don't think we're prepared for it.
Mexico simply isn't prepared for this influx of deportees, including third country nationals, people from Haiti and other countries.
Oh, yeah, that's another deal breaker here as well. I mean, on a good day, we're doing okay. But if they begin to send everybody back that they accepted for asylum hearings, it's going to be a real big problem. And I just don't think that's going to happen.
Father, President Obama prioritized deporting serious criminals, but there were a lot of deportations in his administration, a record number in 2013, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. How many deportees do you have coming through your shelter already?
Well, our shelter can receive 150 people a night. And for the last 10 years, we've had 90% of the people here have been deportees. So we're averaging about 130 right now.
What's it like for these deportees to integrate back into Mexico? Have many of them been in the U.S. for a long time?
Yeah, probably about half of them have been in the U.S. for years. They identify more with the U.S. You know, there are more New England Patriot fans than Chivas fans coming here from the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's a shock. It's like going through a death experience because you get deported, but your family's back in L.A. And it's really hard for people to adjust and to adapt and to adapt to a new country, which is Mexico for them.
There was a report out of Tijuana earlier this week. A 45-year-old Mexican man committed suicide less than an hour after he was deported from the U.S. How do you try to help people deal with the shock and anger of deportation?
Well, here at our Casa, we have several different programs. We have a full-time psychologist, a full-time lawyer. Sometimes people are deported who shouldn't be deported. We have social workers. So if they get here, we're able to work with them one-on-one. The first thing we do is kind of assess how they're doing. That poor man who committed suicide never entered the city. He committed suicide before he got off the bridge. And I hope that's a wake-up call for a lot of people, that people are desperate when they cross that border. You know, one of the things, we have an office at the border, so he would have been asked if he had a place to go from one of our workers. And he said no, probably, and decided to go on his own. If more cases like that begin to surface, I think we're going to have a really big problem here.
How long do they stay with you, Father?
Basically, I'd say most stay for 2 weeks. And if they're interested in finding a job, we have a work department. We can hook them up with a job and, you know, try to, that's part of getting them back on their feet and feeling good. The more we do that, the better it is for them.
Mexico has long been a conduit for people from South and Central America, even Asia, who are trying to cross the border. Do you think stricter enforcement in the U.S. will discourage people from heading to Mexico in the first place to try to cross the border?
No, the only thing that will deter people is if there are no jobs. It's very simple. And the president should understand that. Unfortunately, the jobs that they have are the jobs most Americans will never do. What unemployed person is going to go pick lettuce in the field? So it's all about jobs. When there's no jobs, they don't go. It's also all about fixing things back home, you know, making a contribution in some of these towns that people come from in Mexico and Central America, in these cities where there's so much violence. I just don't think the U.S. is doing enough to help people so that they don't have to immigrate.
Father Patrick Murphy runs the Casa del Migrante shelter in Tijuana, Mexico. Father, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Well, there are currently just two Muslim members of Congress, both Democrats. But American Muslims are starting to get more politically active, including in Maine, where a Muslim immigrant has been elected to the Portland City Council for the first time. Fred Bever of Maine Public Radio reports from Portland.
If the candidates for citizenship would please raise your right hands.
Inside a cavernous glass and steel chamber that overlooks Portland's busy waterfront, dozens of immigrants are about to become U.S. citizens.
I hereby declare that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws.
Roughly 3.5% of Maine's population is foreign-born, and in the last decade or so, the state has seen a significant influx of refugees from conflict zones like Iraq and Somalia. They've concentrated in the state's bigger cities, with Portland the biggest. Most immigrants who want to be naturalized have to wait 5 years to become eligible, but as one speaker at this ceremony notes, these new Americans are not mere citizens. They are now potential voters.
Please do register. That is one of the responsibilities that is required of everyone who is a citizen of this country.
That's Pius Ali, an immigrant from Ghana, slightly overstating the responsibility to vote. Ali earned his U.S. citizenship almost a decade ago, but his emphasis on the importance of voting is easy to understand. On the same day Donald Trump was elected president, Ali was elected to Portland City Council, continuing the political rise of the first African-born Muslim to hold public office in Maine. And he won more votes than any other candidate for city council in at least 20 years. That's a testament to pretty broad support, but Ali says he counted on newly energized immigrant voters to back his candidacy. He adds that all his voters, immigrants or not, want him to be a voice for new Mainers.
I have a very complex identity. I'm a black man in today's America. I am an immigrant, and I also happen to be a Muslim. So with all this complex identity that I have, I can relate and I can speak with many different constituents. They will also feel comfortable reaching out to me instead of maybe other counselors.
He's really been a vital cog in the wheel, if you will, over the last 10 years of trying to make sure that community needs are being heard. He just became a really trusted leader for a lot of people.
Ethan Strimling is Portland's mayor and a political ally of Ali's since Ali made a successful run for the city school board 4 years ago. Strimling now convenes a monthly meeting with Muslim leaders, and he's pushed the startup of a city office to help new Mainers and other underserved residents find work. Strimling says the city's immigrant communities are starting to show some real political muscle.
As more and more of this generation has become citizens and become more active in our schools, you've really started to see it. I think anybody who is in politics in the city of Portland is going to come up very short if they aren't connected to the immigrant community and aren't listening to that community in terms of what their needs and expectations are.
Expectations such as jobs, better school services, inclusion. Councillor Ali wants all of those, but he is starting with smaller bites at the apple and focusing on constituent service. And he's wary of bold moves. He says, for instance, that the time is not ripe for a proposal by Mayor Strimling to allow legal immigrants to vote before they are naturalized. First, Ali says, it's impractical. Needed permission from state government is unlikely, at least for now. The state's governor, Paula Page, it's worth noting, is famous for resisting liberal immigration policies. Second, Ali says, recent immigrants from unstable countries need time to settle and learn before jumping into a pretty poisonous political environment here in the U.S.
Politics is already toxic as it is right now. So to bring in people who do not have a vast understanding of this will be a disservice to that community. So totally great idea, but there's a lot of work to be done.
National data show that recently naturalized citizens tend to vote at lower rates than those who've been here for decades or are U.S. born. At the recent waterfront naturalization ceremony, there was an appreciable line at a table the League of Women Voters set up to help fresh minted citizens register. Luc Armand Nigamirize says he arrived here from Burundi 5 years ago and he looks to Pius Ali to carry the immigrant banner into city politics.
When I was congratulating him, I'd say, wow, now we are seeing your steps. So just know that there are some other people behind you who are doing the same steps as he did. So it's a great victory, not only for him, but also for the immigrant communities around Portland.
Nigamiritse had another message for Ali. The councillor could count on his vote in the next election. For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever in Portland, Maine.
And now to the most exciting news of the week. Astronomers have discovered 7 Earth-sized planets orbiting a dwarf star just 40 light-years from Earth. That's 235 trillion miles, which is pretty close in cosmic terms. The dwarf star is called TRAPPIST-1, and astronomers say the planets could have liquid water and the right conditions for life. Dr. Doug Hudgens is a program scientist for NASA's Exoplanet Exploration Program. He's with us now. Dr. Hudgens, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And I feel like we get announcements like this, maybe not exactly like this, but like this every so often. But how exciting was this one in particular?
Well, this is really exciting because it has to do with worlds that are actually really the size of the Earth. We've found over the last 5 or 6 years that planets are tremendously abundant, that when you look up at the night sky and see the stars, basically every star that you're looking at has at least one planet around it and probably more than that. But the majority of the planets that we've found so far have been large planets the size of Jupiter or even Neptune in our own planetary system. Just because they're bigger, they're easier to find. Earth-sized planets are more tricky. They're small. But they're also the most exciting ones because, of course, we believe that in order for life to exist, you need to have a planet with a rocky surface that can support the existence of liquid water and a hospitable atmosphere in the habitable zone of its planet. So here we found a system that not only has one such planet, but actually it has 7 such planets, Earth-sized, 3 of which fall in the zone where they could possibly support liquid water and life on the surface.
And this star, this dwarf star that these planets are orbiting, is much smaller than our sun, right?
Yeah, it's only about 10% the size of our sun. It's much smaller, much cooler than our sun. So these planets are much closer to them, their orbit, because they basically have to snuggle up closer to this star to get enough heat to be in the habitable zone.
What are you most curious to find out about this?
Well, I'm most curious right away to find out whether they have atmospheres. The tiny red dwarf, or red dwarfs in general, are, although they're small and cool, they tend to have rather tempestuous lives, particularly the early stages. In fact, this star itself we have already looked at with X-ray telescopes, and it's emitting copious amounts of X-rays. So there's been a lot of debate within the scientific community about whether planets around an M dwarf could potentially be habitable because of the negative effects of, you know, very energetic flares and X-rays from the star itself. Strangely enough, smaller and dimmer than our sun, our sun is a very nice, well-behaved, very gentle star as these things go.
So how long until we know if there's life on these planets?
Well, that's a bit of a guessing game. What that comes down to is, can we find a signature in the atmosphere of the planet, the composition or something like that, that we think is really a smoking gun for life? If we found something that we couldn't explain with any other way than the action of living organisms, then we would have some compelling sign of life. I tend to think that nobody is going to really regard it as a smoking gun until we can look at the planet directly, study its light, figure out whether it has oceans and clouds and landforms, and possibly even begin to see like the fingerprints of vegetation in the spectrum or something like that. I think that's going to be what we'll need, and that's probably another 20 to 50 years down the road.
Okay, well, that brings me to my last question to you, which is, we're saying this is 40 light years away, which sounds close compared to what some other things in outer space are. But
that's right.
That doesn't mean that we could get there in 40 years because, of course, we can't travel at the speed of light at the moment.
That's exactly right. Not with our current technology. I liked the analogy that I heard one of the scientists say yesterday that, you know, if United was so excited that they decided to schedule a flight to this and you got on it and flew at the speed of a typical airliner, you probably would be in for about a 44 million year trip
okay.
to get there. So you hope they packed more than snack boxes.
Right, and that you weren't in a basic economy seat where you couldn't put anything in the overhead bin
right.
for free.
At least economy plus.
At least economy plus. Dr. Doug Hudgens, program scientist for NASA's Exoplanet Exploration Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And staying with the stars, the Academy Awards are this weekend. And joining us now to talk about some menu suggestions for Oscar night watching is Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I'm reminded of the conversation that we had a few months ago for food to serve on election night. And you had those great nachos with one side for Hillary Clinton with jalapenos and the other side for Donald Trump with, I think, overcooked steak or something. Was that what it was?
Yes. Yes,
right.
It was.
Okay. So you've got some lighter menu suggestions for Oscar night.
Well, year after year, I get suckered in. I watch these things every year since I was a kid. And unlike some people who have parties and get dressed up, our tradition is we put on our pajamas, we put on our bathrobes, and we have all kinds of finger foods and little tastes of this and that. And we watch these awards. And this year, maybe more than ever, we need the frivolity, the distraction, the fun of feeling part of Hollywood and glam and so we got to eat, you know?
We got to eat. And we got to drink, which is what you've got right here in front of me. What is this drink? And by the way, it's not alcoholic.
It's not alcoholic, though it does not need to be. It's a ginger maple soda or a ginger maple cocktail. You make a syrup with fresh chunks of ginger, a little bit of water and sugar, and a touch of maple syrup, which gives it that mapley, earthy sweetness. And then you strain that, and you can keep that in your refrigerator for 2 weeks, and you can have it with soda water and watch the Oscars and have a good old time.
However, refreshing.
Yes, it's delicious, and it's really good for you. Ginger is very good for you. But you could add that syrup to Prosecco or champagne, or you can mix it with fresh lime juice and rum. Many people like to serve interesting cocktails at Oscar parties, so ginger maple cocktail. How about that?
Pretty good. And you could put that together
pretty
with...
Pretty good.
Very good, Kathy. Very
there
good.
There you go. I want to hear it.
And you could put that together with these toasts here with a spread. Tell us about this.
This is called a tartine, and a tartine is simply bread or toast with a sweet or savory topping. This is very California, very la-la-la-la.
We should remind people, by the way, that you're joining us from California right now because you always go to the Oscars and sit in the front row.
That's right. I mean, you know, my seat next to Meryl is there every year.
Right.
This is a ricotta cheese with grated lemon zest on really good crusty bread, whatever you have around or can find. And then you drizzle it with some sweet honey and some chopped salted pistachios. So pistachios and lemon being so California. This is kind of sweet, but it's also savory and will take you 5 minutes to make.
And by the way, just to set the record straight, Kathy is in California, but she's not going to be at the Oscars, sadly.
What?
That was a joke.
What?
What? Well, one more
Wait
thing.
A minute.
One more
I
thing
you
we got to get
ticket.
To, Kathy, here is the popcorn you've brought, because of course you have to have popcorn when you're watching the
popcorn,
Oscars.
Popcorn, ultimate movie watching food, but it doesn't have to be same old, same old. I do one with Middle Eastern spices where you mix up ground black pepper, a little allspice, cinnamon, nutmeg, and Aleppo pepper, if you can find that. Really good, a little bit of spice, but really wonderful blend that you just add to your warm popcorn. I also do one with spicy turmeric and sharp cheddar cheese. Turmeric is an anti-inflammatory, and it turns the popcorn this gorgeous saffron yellowy orange, and the sharp cheddar melts a little bit, and boy, popcorn never tasted better. Mm. You can flavor your popcorn with anything, Parmesan cheese and fresh thyme, any kind of herb, spice, cheese, olive oil, butter, really just to... The Oscars is all about glam, and this just kind of elevates popcorn, which is such an everyday food, into something a little bit special.
Yeah, and still you have to eat it the way that we all eat popcorn, which is to stuff as much into your hand as possible and then put it in your mouth, because you never know when the popcorn is going to disappear and you won't be able to eat the rest of it. Why do we eat it like that?
So true. Because it's like so airy and you just feel like you want a lot of it. But when you're still hungry, you could think about maybe making a cheese fondue. We're going to have a recipe on the website. And then for dessert, I made these caramels where I just took store-bought caramels and melted a really good bar of dark chocolate, dipped the caramels in on all sides, and sprinkled it with very coarse sea salt. You can buy salted chocolate caramels, but they cost a fortune. So these are DIY salted caramels.
And will all of this last you when the Oscars goes past 11 p.m. on the East Coast?
On the East Coast, if you can stay awake, you're going to need those caramels. On the West Coast, I hear people dress up and, you know, it's not so late here. So people are ready to eat more and stay awake and kind of eat more main coursey kind of things. I also have a great recipe for what I call a chunky Oscar guacamole, which is not the traditional mash, but this is where you cube really ripe California avocados with lime juice and lime zest and cilantro and chilies. You could top it with pomegranate seeds, lots of vegetables and warm tortillas. Just really good finger food that keeps you going as you watch this unbelievably long show. Every year it seems to be longer and longer. But again, fun and a nice distraction from the troubles of the world.
And given the amount of California references in our segment, I assume that you're rooting for La La Land.
Maybe, maybe not. I'm very mixed. But, you know, I'll be there in the front row, so right. My vote will count.
We'll be watching for you. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef. And we've got all these recipes at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin told CNBC today that he's committed to finishing tax reform before Congress goes on its summer recess.
That's really our focus. We want to get this done by the August recess. We've been working closely with the leadership in the House and the Senate, and we're working on a combined plan.
He said he's focused on middle-income tax cuts and making the business tax competitive with the rest of the world. Here to look at what we can expect is Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us in the studio. Hey, Kurt, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Eric.
So Republicans have promised an ambitious tax reform program. I mean, how realistic is this summer timeline?
Well, it's realistic in the sense that there's not a lot of political opposition to stop them, right? They control the White House. They control both houses of Congress. So on paper, no problem. They should be able to get it through. It is pretty ambitious. We don't know the details of all of this yet, but you're really looking at reforming individual taxes, corporate taxes, also adding border taxes. So it's pretty sweeping and it's a lot of work. And so it's realistic, but also not unthinkable that it could get stalled.
Right. And the Democrats don't really have the ability to stop it. House Republicans have also been talking about what's known as the border adjustment, which would tax just certain imports. This has gotten some criticism from retailers and other businesses. There's also a divide over this in Congress. I mean, what's the status of that idea, Kurt?
Well, Secretary Mnuchin said today that there's still some concerns about that, but also has some interesting aspects. Supporters say this would make U.S. trade more competitive by sort of concentrating more economic activity within the U.S. A lot of criticism from retailers saying that you know, prices at your local Walmart's going to go up and that it would actually raise inflation. Economists have concerns too, so very much on the table. And honestly, we haven't seen the details of this. We just know that this idea has been floated, but no specifics yet from the administration.
The worry is that retailers would pass the prices on to consumers.
Right.
Yeah. So back in November, Mnuchin told CNBC that he wanted, quote, no absolute tax cut for the upper class, end quote. It's something Democrats have begun calling the Mnuchin rule. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism, Kurt. He'll be able to stick to that.
Yeah, it would be nice to sort of put his name on it so he has to stick to it, right? Have a little bit of a legacy. Mnuchin backed off from that a little bit today. He wasn't as explicit. But the idea here is that, you know, you can lower taxes for upper income earners, but then get rid of a lot of the deductions. And so he's saying generally overall, it'll be simpler, but overall they would spend less money. Overall they would spend about the same amount of money on taxes. That's what Democrats want to hold him to, essentially.
Well, what are some other things you're looking at that House Republicans are looking at as well to do, and how would they pay for them?
Yeah, I mean, this is lowering, for instance, the corporate income tax from 35% down to 25% for like other businesses like sole proprietorships. This does cost a lot. It means that there's going to be trillions probably in revenue that doesn't come into the U.S. over the next decade. But it also would spur growth. And the levels of this are all what's really debatable, but that's the idea, that it spurs more growth and that would end up paying for that.
We'll have to keep on it. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks for coming in.
You got it.
Data out this month from the traffic information company INRIX show Los Angeles has the worst traffic in the world. Drivers in L.A. spent an average of 104 hours stuck in traffic during peak hours in 2016, and 10 of the world's 25 most traffic-clogged cities are in the United States. In Europe, some cities are trying to tackle congestion by limiting cars and making it easier for people to walk or bike. The city of Paris has banned cars from a stretch of road along the Seine River, and the mayor is planning to extend that car-free zone even more next year. Joining us from Vancouver is Charles Montgomery, who's an urbanist and the author of the book Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And changes like these car bans are not always greeted warmly by everyone. In Paris, the mayor is extending car-free zones despite a backlash from suburban mayors and pro-car advocates. What are the benefits of something like this, first of all?
Well, it's important to note that the changes in Paris are just the latest step in a series of changes that have been going on there for years. And cities all over the world are doing this simply because it makes sense. There just isn't enough room to accomplish what cities want to accomplish, which is what? Provide a robust economy, help people get to work, get people to shops and services, and beyond that, to provide a good, healthy lifestyle for people. So they're having to find new ways to move people around. And they've found that, geez, maybe it's not the most efficient way to apportion our streets when we're giving 80% of road space to the least efficient mode of transport. So that's the main reason this is happening. But it's also happening because people in inner cities are demanding it.
Do you have to, though, replace the mode of transportation? If you take away the car from a particular area, can that area just be for pedestrians to walk around, or do you have to give people another option to get through that area quickly?
Yeah, that's a really good point. For these things to work, you need to give people alternative ways to move around. And so that means having a fantastic transit system so people can get there in other ways, in other high-status ways, faster than a car would get there. You need a robust network of safe, separated bike lanes, because we know 60% of people in cities want to try biking around but are too scared to do it on the unsafe infrastructure that's out there. But, you know, we're talking about mobility here. You also need to talk about land use. I mean, the best form of mobility out there is proximity. In other words, just being close enough to walk to stuff. So having mixed-use neighborhoods where people can walk to stuff. And, you know, Paris is a good example of that.
Well, I remember when they tried to do this in New York City and tried to take some of the streets around Times Square and close them off to cars, and so that they would be just for pedestrians, because there are so many pedestrians in that area, it was becoming difficult. And they did it, but it was not easy. They got a lot of pushback from people who wanted the cars to continue to be able to go as they always had.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. There's usually a great deal of opposition before these changes take place. And then after the changes take place, in a few months or a couple of years, polls show that people are largely in support of the changes. In New York City, for example, yeah, they shut down access for most vehicles in parts of Broadway and along Times Square. And guess what they found a few months later is that the north-south trips, taxis, were moving much more quickly than before to get to the south end of Manhattan, because they got rid of a tangled up sort of intersection bow tie. In Stockholm, for example, people really opposed a congestion charge for travel into the central city. A year or so after bringing it in, everybody's largely in favor. Because why? Well, it helps people who insist on driving to get there more easily with less traffic.
So you think that taking away cars from the roads or making roads inaccessible to cars does not create more traffic in other areas?
Well, I feel like I need to rephrase what you're saying. You were characterizing this as taking something away from cars. I think particularly in America, you need to be talking about freedom, and that is a freedom to move through your cities in a variety of ways. And most Americans don't enjoy that freedom. But to answer your question, what effect does it have? Well, I'm not sure if you've heard of the phrase induced demand. And this is a phrase we hear from traffic engineers who are realizing that when they create new road space in cities in order to deal with traffic congestion, it works, but only for about 3 or 4 years, and then it stops working because people change their travel behavior or move further away. So just as that has happened in L.A. With inner-city freeway improvements, what we're finding in other cities around the world is when you take some of that automobility space away, it does not seem to push traffic into other areas, if great transit is provided.
But, you talk about how cities should replace some of what's lost to cars by expanding their transit systems. Obviously, that's a very expensive thing to do. It's much cheaper to just say this is going to be a car-free zone and everybody's going to just have to deal with it than to say, and now let's build a big subway system to replace it.
Well, is it really much cheaper? I mean, yeah, Americans have been massively subsidizing travel by car for decades now, and massively under-subsidizing public transit and other ways of moving. My friends at a database journalism outfit called Discourse Media studied the cost to society of different ways of traveling here in Metro Vancouver when we had a transit referendum. And what they found was pretty amazing. When you travel in a car to work every day, you're costing society a significant amount. I've forgotten the specific numbers, but not just for the cost of the roads, but for the cost of healthcare and reduced productivity and shortened productive years. When people are taking transit or walking or cycling, for example, the infrastructure costs are lower and the payback to society is much higher in terms of better health, greater productivity, and lower healthcare costs.
So, do you expect to see more of these car-free zones brought to the United States, for example?
I think what we're seeing all over the world, and increasingly in the United States, is a recognition that the old way of moving isn't working. Now, you started with the example of Paris. Those changes can seem very extreme to Americans who are used to a certain kind of city, a certain way of moving. And I think the most successful cities make these changes incrementally, and then people demand more of them. That's what happened in a city like Copenhagen, where they just started with pedestrianizing a delightful street in their city heart, and then doing it a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And people enjoyed it, and they asked for more. I think the changes we're seeing most in American cities are those changes that involve building bike infrastructure. Finally, American cities are starting to move on this. We see it in not just Portland, but Washington, Philadelphia, Minneapolis. Minneapolis, for example, a city that actually plows its bike lanes so people can cycle in the middle of winter.
By the way, Charles, your book is called Happy City. What's the happiest city in your mind that you've been to?
There's a bit of happy in every city, actually. I think if you're looking specifically at design, Copenhagen seems to take the cake now. So it's a place that's immensely walkable. And when we say walkable, I don't just mean pedestrian zones. I mean, they started with amazing sidewalks and wonderful street edges where there's lovely shops and services and reasons to lure you along further on your walk. And, of course, they have great, safe bike infrastructure. So now 50% of people in Copenhagen are commuting by bike, not because they're being forced to, but because it's easy and fun.
You're in a pretty great city right now. You're joining us from Vancouver, which is, for people who haven't been there, just a beautiful city. Everywhere you look, these incredible views of the mountains and the water and the buildings right in the center of the city. It's very unique, but just a beautiful space and very walkable.
Yeah, you know, we made a big decision in the late 60s when the high modernist planners thought, hey, let's wrap the city in freeways. Let's wrap it up in a nice big bow. The longtime residents of Chinatown just said, hell no, they put a stop to it. And so we are the only major city in North America without a downtown freeway network. And we've benefited immensely from this. In fact, in the last 10 years, some people might find this shocking. In the last 10 years, you know, the city of Vancouver has had a policy of not adding any new road space while they add protected bike lanes and better pedestrian infrastructure. And guess what? We're the only city in Canada where during that time, commute times have shortened. In other words, people are getting to work faster here, even though cars are moving more slowly. So people say, why is that happening? Well, it's happening because people are moving closer to their workplace because we have wonderful mixed-use communities where you can do that. And they're also choosing other ways of moving, and we have a very robust transit system.
That's Charles Montgomery, who is an urbanist and author of the book Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
U.S.-backed Iraqi soldiers today are pushing deeper into Islamic State-controlled areas of Mosul as the months-long offensive continues. The intense fight today is for control of Mosul's international airport and a nearby military base. New York Times correspondent Ben C. Solomon has been on the front lines with Iraqi soldiers and special forces in Mosul. He joins us via Skype from the outskirts of the city. Ben, you recently traveled with Iraqi soldiers deep inside the eastern side of Mosul. Your video and print reports show total devastation. Describe more of what you saw.
Well, it's been really rough. A lot of Mosul that we're kind of seeing is in two parts. One is in the east, which is fully liberated. And the east, for all of its destruction, is actually pretty impressive in how well it's coming back to life. A lot of the city has a lot of parts of it that are still kind of still standing, and some of the markets that are still open. So a lot of the buildings and the destructions, in comparison to some of the other cities that I've seen, like Fallujah, which was completely destroyed, are actually pretty in pretty good shape. But for the most part, a lot of the city was really beaten down by airstrikes, and a lot of the infrastructure that went along with having the occupation of ISIS for 2 years has made it really hard for people to come back. So all around, we're seeing a lot of things being challenged by just the movements of this fight.
So businesses, schools on the liberated side are starting to try to come back.
Yeah, it's really surprising. And at the same time, just kind of a part of the fabric of life for the people around there. I mean, the people of Mosul and the people of Iraq and all have all seen a lot of war and a lot of destruction over the past 10, 15 years.
Ben, you even went to a local school that's now reopened. Here's some sound from your report. Let's take a listen.
Deeper into the city, we came across a school, and the students are really excited to be back. Over the last 2 years, ISIS has forced local schools to teach their own sort of propaganda syllabus, and the principal here tells us that only 20% of the students had been coming to school. Now they are completely overloaded with students.
Ben, it's kind of incredible that a school is actually open there so soon after it was controlled by ISIS.
Yeah, it was one of the most inspirational and exciting things that we got to witness, which is the fact that these kids that were really, you know, held back for about 2 years and hadn't really had any education at all. When we went to visit the school, which had been open for just about a week, they were absolutely just brimming. These kids were so excited, and it was just such a nice sight to see all these young people kind of really eager to learn.
Ben, ISIS has had months to dig in and prepare. What are you seeing and hearing today traveling with Iraqi forces?
Well, today we just came back from the front lines with the special forces here. And they have just started the fight pushing forward towards the airport. My colleague took a look at some of the overhead satellite footage and some of the drones and said that it's completely devastated. We haven't got a chance to see it yet, but from the looks of things, it's going to be completely beat down. We weren't allowed to go in. We were hoping we could get a chance to kind of embed with the soldiers and push our way to the front with them. But the special forces soldiers that we were working with told us it's way too dangerous. It's completely insecure. It's full of booby traps. And I think that we kind of made the decision as a group to kind of not push in today. Kind of wait to see how it kind of pans out over the next few days.
The fight for Mosul started months ago. Ben, is there a sense that this push into the western side and the airfield is the final battle, or are ISIS fighters deeply entrenched throughout the urban center?
Yeah, it's pretty complicated now. The Iraqi forces have the city surrounded. On the south, they've just kind of taken control through the different villages and spent the past few days kind of clearing out some of the smaller villages that still had ISIS kind of in them. And now they're taking a push from the west as well, inward. So a lot of the thinking of the next few days is they're going to push up through the airport, take over that airport and use it as a staging area to then push into the city. If you look at the difference between eastern Mosul and western Mosul, eastern Mosul is a grid. It's got simple roads. Western Mosul is more of the older city. It's much more winding. It's much more smaller, narrow roads that are really hard to get Humvees down. So the fight there is going to be really long and tough. The idea now is that they have to really prepare themselves by surrounding it in a much more effective way and have staging points. But I think this battle is going to really last for a couple months at least.
Ben, finally, how are civilians holding up? They always take the brunt in conflicts. Can you tell me what you know from civilians you've run into?
It's clear that something like the figures that the UN are releasing is something like 800,000 people are under siege there. And a lot of the people we talked to seemed really happy just to be getting out from the rule of ISIS. But now it's complicated as to where they'll go. The refugee camps are going to be overloaded. I think in the eastern offensive, it was easier to fight around these people and fight around the civilian places. In the west, I think it'll be harder. It'll be a lot more complicated. And seeing as this will probably be ISIS's last stand in this place, I'm sure it'll be a much harder fight and a much more kind of problematic place for civilians to be. So I'd expect some pretty devastating times ahead for the people of Mosul.
New York Times reporter Ben C. Solomon traveling with Iraqi special forces in Mosul. Ben, thank you and stay safe.
Thanks a lot.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.